Greetings of the day. I, Ashima Vij, on behalf of APS Mamoon, welcome you all at our podcast Words Birds with the theme World Ocean Day. World Ocean Day is celebrated annually on 8th June to remind us of the important role of the oceans in sustaining our livelihoods and the necessity to prevent them from destruction. According to the United Nations, oceans are the lungs of our planet and a major source of food and medicine and a critical part of the biosphere. World Ocean Day is celebrated to highlight the importance of water bodies as they provide shelter to countless fauna and flora which provide us with life-saving oxygen. Furthermore, it is celebrated to generate awareness about human activities like dumping plastic pollution, garbage disposal, oil leaks to send a message to save the oceans. World Oceans Day 2022 theme is revitalization, that is, collective action for the ocean. As per the UN, World Oceans Day is celebrated to inform the public of the impact of human actions on the ocean and to develop a worldwide movement of citizens for the oceans. On this day, various thought leaders, celebrities, institutional partners, entrepreneurs, industry experts talk about biodiversity and economic opportunity that the ocean sustains. To me, the sea is a continual miracle. The fishes that swim, the rocks are the motion of wave ships with men in them. What strange miracles are there? Has been said by Walt Whitman. Thank you.
Greetings of the day. Annie Harika in School Flyers section is going to update you all regarding fortnightly school news. Successful culmination of summer camp on 3rd June. Seminar on Youth Parliament was conducted on 3rd June for classes 10th and 12th. Second round of Ethics Bowl was conducted on 9th June. Summer vacations for classes 10th and 12th will start from 10th June and school will reopen on 4th July. Class 12th last board exam was on 13th June.
Namaskar. Today in the book review section, we are going to review this book Sea Power by Admiral James Stavridis. When it comes to sheer size, the Pacific Ocean reigns supreme. Believe it or not, you could combine every landmass on the planet and it would still be smaller than the Pacific's 64 million square miles of surface area. Perhaps the most celebrated sailor of the Pacific Ocean was James Cook, a captain in the British Royal Navy. Cook embarked on a series of voyages in the late 1700s that charted what was previously unknown, including key ports in places like Hawaii, Tahiti, Western Canada, Eastern Islands, and parts of New Zealand. The United States greatly increased its interest in the Pacific following the gold rush in the mid-1800s. During this time, people from all over the country flocked to gold-rich hills of the US West Coast, just as coal power ships were being introduced. These boats required coaling stations for long trips across the Pacific, which is exactly what Hawaii became when it was annexed by the United States in 1898. To this day, Hawaiian Island continue to serve as a reliable gateway for the United States in the Pacific. A far more questionable land deal was made by the United States in 1867 when Secretary of State William Seward orchestrated the purchase of Alaska from Russia. Unlike Hawaii, this land was in much chillier part of the northern Pacific Ocean, and many vocal critics believe Seward had wasted money on the useless chunk of frozen tundra. People may have called it Seward's folly at that time, but now we know Alaska came to play a key role in US economy further down the road. The Pacific Ocean was a battlefield in the World War II also, and it's currently home to a dangerous arms race. For many Americans, what happened at Pearl Harbor in the final days in 1941 still stands as a singular event. It was a devastating surprise attack on the US military base, unlike any that has happened before or since. And it made World War II something the United States could no longer ignore. The United States would go on to spend years fighting Japanese forces in the Pacific, a massive oceanic battlefield that spanned a distance equivalent to the English Channel to the Persian Gulf. These days, there is a new rivalry emerging on the horizon for the dominance in the Pacific, that is US and China. Between 2013 and 2015, China increased its military spending by 26%. Now let's talk about Atlantic Ocean. The Vikings were the first Atlantic explorers. Covering 40 million square miles, the Atlantic Ocean is the second only to the Pacific in terms of size. The Greeks were likely the first to voyage into the unknown open waters of the Atlantic. But as far as recorded history goes, the Vikings were the first European to venture out and catch sight of the New World. The Portuguese also began exploring the Atlantic in the 15th and the 16th century. But these were voyages of different kind. While the Vikings are generally considered explorers, the Portuguese are seen as discoverers, who by contrast were on a mission to expand and colonize. And that's just what they did. With the help of new ships that had multiple masts and sails, and sailors who had improved navigational methods that included a keen understanding of the stars. One of the most important of the early Portuguese explorers was Infante Henrique, or Prince Henry, the navigator, as he came to be known, who discovered the abundance of spices and gold that lay in the northern Africa. He was followed by the Vasco da Gama, Bartolomeu Dias, and Pedro Alvarez Cabral. Cabral would eventually launch an epic voyage in the early 16th century, one that would forever connect Europe with South America, the Indian Ocean, and Asia. Great Britain has unrivaled record of naval supremacy in the Atlantic. In the 1500s, King Henry VIII pushed forward England to become a major player in the seafaring world, and the country never looked back, proving time and again that it was the home to the world's best naval force. Henry ordered heavily armed warships to be built just in time to challenge Spain for European supremacy. In the 1600s, the Dutch were the Britain's next rival, followed by France in the 1700s. The Royal Navy eventually bested both of them while making the key acquisitions of Canada and several Caribbean islands. However, when the French came to the aid of the rebellious Americans, they did manage to deliver one of the only significant defeats in British history. This occurred during the American Revolution of the 1770s. At the time, the Americans didn't have a naval force that could compete with Great Britain, but they did have a willing partner, that is France. In 1781, the France outgunned the British at the sea near Yorktown, helping to secure the independence of the United States. The British would eventually reclaim naval dominance over the United States in the War of 1812, which led to the peace treaty and the special relationship between the two powers that was tested during the wars of the 20th century. Now let's move towards Indian Ocean. The Indian Ocean has always been a valuable trade route, and today it is also an important area of resources. Since the days of ancient Greece, the Indian Ocean has been a venue to trade spices, textiles, livestock, and just about anything else that could fit on a boat. For centuries, Arabs, Persians, and Chinese all used this water to trade peacefully among themselves. In the late 1400s, the Portuguese became the dominant traders in the Indian Ocean, but they were surpassed by the British East India Company and the Dutch East India Company in the 1600s. These two companies eventually merged, and by the 1800s, the Indian Ocean became known as the British Lake. Around this time, the Suez Canal also became the protectorate of the British. Located in Egypt, it offered the valuable link between the Northern Atlantic and the Indian Ocean via Mediterranean Sea and the Red Sea. By the time the steam engine arrived on the scene in the 19th century, the British had acquired strategic territories such as Egypt, India, Iraq, Kuwait, Sudan, Kenya, and Singapore. When World War II broke out, the British believed Singapore would withstand any invasion, but it came under Japanese control from 1942 to 1945. During this time, the Axis powers of Germany and Japan had a gateway into the Indian Ocean, and the 200 years of being a British lake came to an end. By the late 1960s, the British began a strategic withdrawal from the Indian Ocean. Meanwhile, incredible natural resources had been discovered in the area, especially in the Arabian Gulf. For most of the human history, locations like Abu Dhabi, Bahrain, and Dubai were predominantly known as humble fishing villages. But in the mid-20th century, these locations were revealed to be home to as much as two-thirds of the world's oil reserves and a third of its natural gas, thereby completely changing their status. Today, the Indian Ocean is home to dangerous tensions. The relationship between China and India has also been highly antagonistic. While China continues to expand its influence around the Indian Ocean, it is likely that India will eventually overtake China as the most populous nation in the world. Just how important is the Indian Ocean? Well, 50% of the world's shipping pass through these waters, which some would say it is more important than either Atlantic or the Pacific Ocean. The United States would also be wise to better recognize India's potential as a global leader, since it is a democratic nation and holds many of the same values as United States. More could and should be done to bring the two nations together. Now let's talk about Arctic Ocean. Global warming is very much a reality, and if you need a tangible evidence, the unprecedented melting of the Arctic should be exhibit number one. For every degree that Earth's overall temperature increases, the temperature of the North Pole rises by 5 degrees. And while the situation has its dangers, it also comes with opportunity. When the Arctic permafrost melts, it could release catastrophic levels of methane into the atmosphere. And while we should be doing all we can to meet the goals of the Paris Climate Agreement, we must consider the reality of the situation. As the ice recedes, new maritime routes are opening up. Russia is already moving to be the dominant force in the more open Arctic Ocean. Knowing all too well the vast reserves of oil, natural gas, and untold valuable metals that are to be found in the Arctic, not to mention the new fishing areas. Russia is in constant competition with Canada, Norway, and Denmark, which control the Greenland over territory. But the United States has a major stake as well. Drawing territorial lines in the Arctic has the potential to be one of the most important geopolitical developments of our day. So it is important that the US plays its cards right and not to be left in the dust. The Arctic has traditionally been an afterthought for the US, and even though Obama became the first president to visit the area, the country still lacks a clear and visible strategy. First of all, more icebreaker ships need to be acquired, as United States currently has only 3, while Russia has more than 30. There is also work to be done by NATO as well as Russia to form cooperative partnership and centers for operation. So positive and long-term results can be achieved if we work on improving the conditions and political stability in the region where piracy begins. Another very serious problem that must be addressed is pollution and overfishing. There is always public outrage when an accident occurs. For example, when millions of gallons of oil spilled into the sea into the Deepwater Horizon disaster of 2010, or the Exxon Valdez spill in 1989. These were certainly tragic events, but they are not where our attention should be focused. Big spills like these are quite rare compared to the steady amount of toxins being dumped into the oceans by numerous companies every day. Experts suggest that industrial and agricultural companies are pouring around 500 million gallons worth of poison into the ocean every year. Then there is a very immediate crisis of overfishing, which has resulted in 90% of every fish stock being exploited and overfished. Things have gotten so out of hand that number of old fish stocks are at half of what they were in 1970s. Clearly, this is not sustainable behavior. Simply put, we need international maritime cooperation as well as improved international treaty on maritime law that includes fishing regulation and more protected waters. One of the determining factors of a nation's naval power is its geography. You will not get as far as seafaring nation unless you have a good amount of coastline and easy access to the open waters. If that's the case, the nation must then make sure of its policies and politics are aligned with the many ways the sea can bring prosperity. This means having beneficial trade policies and foreign relations, while also putting enough money aside to build great ships and have well-trained crews. Great Britain is perhaps the best example of mighty naval power that used all these factors to its advantage. In the South China Sea, there needs to be more US submarines to balance out what other nations have in the area, as well as to establish a state-of-the-art THAAD or Terminal High Altitude Area Defense System. The systems could work along with Japanese and South Korean allies to destroy any dangerous missile strikes coming from North Korea. In the Indian Ocean, friendly ties need to be established with India, New Zealand, Australia by conducting more cooperative military training missions. Finally, in the Arctic Ocean, besides adding least 4 more icebreaker ships, more ports need to be opened and an emergency search and rescue base need to be established. After all, the Arctic is a dangerous place. In the end, it takes a strong naval power to maintain peace and prosperity in the world. The oceans of the world have amazing stories to tell, showing us how remarkably humanity's achievements have been over the years, but also revealing how far we still have to go. By understanding our history through the lens of the naval power, we can identify the mistakes of the past and steer clear of them in the future. From climate change and overfishing to terrorist threats and nuclear weapons, the world is home to many potential catastrophic issues that require decisive actions. Thanks.
The ocean has its silent caves, deep, quiet, and alone. Though there be fury on the waves, beneath them there is none. The awful spirits of the deep hold their communion there, and there are those for whom we weep, the young, the bright, the fair. Calmly the wearied seamen rest beneath their own blue sea. The ocean solitudes are blessed, for there is purity. The earth has killed, the earth has cared, unquiet are its graves, but peaceful sleep is ever there, beneath the dark blue waves.
Namaskar, I, Shekhar Sharma, along with my student Simran, welcome you all in the last section of our podcast, Deliberations. And today the topic of discussion is oceans. So Simran, there are so many problems are being faced by oceans. That is plastic pollution, oil spill, overfishing, and the destruction of coral reefs, etc. So could you please suggest some ways through which we can protect our oceans?
The year 2050 has been predicted by some to be a bleak year for the ocean. Experts say that by 2050, there may be more plastic than fish in the sea, or perhaps only plastic left. Others say 90% of our coral reefs may be dead, waves of mass marine extinction may be unleashed, and our seas may be left overheated, acidified, and lacking oxygen. It is easy to forget that 2050 is not that far off. Kids we see building sandcastles on the beach today might be gaining traction in their jobs and perhaps starting their own families. The possibility that our children may inherit from us such a broken and diminished ocean is hard to accept. Such a future, however, is not yet written in stone. A healthier, more whole, and maybe even more profitable future ocean may still be within reach, at least for a little while. Here are 10 steps that could take us towards a more desirable ocean future. Number 1. Freeze the warming. Stopping climate change is the hardest but most important step we can take for ocean health. It is good news to have the US back in the Paris Agreement. However, we now need ambitious national commitments to achieve carbon neutrality from all signatories of the agreement. Recent actions by China, the European Union, Japan and the UK are also positive. Number 2. Walk the talk. We need to make these carbon neutrality commitments real. This will require massive new investment in renewable energy sources, including some more experimental solutions, plus potentially looking with open minds into making older low carbon energy solutions safer and more viable. We need to fast track the development of sustainable next generation batteries to store this energy intelligently across our grids. This includes major needs for marine energy infrastructure. A future, for example, with electrified ports and low emission ships would help eliminate the epidemic of deafening ocean noise, address environmental injustices associated with pollution in ports, make oil spills a thing of the past, and significantly reduce global emissions. Number 3. Blue Revolution. The Green Revolution, a massive ramping up of food production on land in the 1950s, has belatedly reached the sea. Ocean farming or aquaculture has increased by more than 1000% in the ocean recently. The Green Revolution was sloppily executed, and the first baby steps of the Blue Revolution have included similar stumbles. Chemical pollution, genetic pollution, and habitat destruction. But the Blue Revolution can still clean up its act. Farming in the right places, with the right species, and the right practices could make aquaculture a win for human and environmental health. Ocean food research could also help us meet growing demand for seafood sustainably. Number 4. 30 into 30. Parks protect some of our most important chunks of nature on land, our Yellowstones and Serengetis. We are vastly behind setting up parks in the sea. We need to follow through on calls to protect 30% of our ocean by 2030. This must be as much about quality as quantity. We need to use intelligent planning algorithms and the intelligence of local and indigenous people to select the very best 30% of the sea to protect. Then, the hard work begins. We must protect and deploy new technology to monitor and protect the living assets we put in these ocean savings accounts. Number 5. The other 70%. An ocean industrial revolution is beginning. Human industry is growing at exponential rates in the sea. Even if we succeed in protecting 30% of the ocean, we must still intelligently zone and manage this accelerated anthropogenic growth in the majority of our unprotected ocean. We largely miss that boat on land. Proactive steps to sustainably onboard an ocean industrial revolution include responsibly managing wild capture fisheries, carefully zoning what marine industries go where, eliminating harmful fisheries subsidies, and coming to grips with the fact that some new marine industries like ocean mining are simply too dangerous to be allowed into the ocean. Number 6. Big cracks in the sea. Most of the ocean belongs to us all. This includes the 2/3 of the ocean in the high seas that lies beyond all nations' ocean borders and the marine regions surrounding Antarctica. Protection of biodiversity and equitable sharing of resources has slipped through antiquated governance gaps in these international ocean spaces. But a proposed new UN treaty for high seas biodiversity and negotiations to sustainably manage and protect Antarctic waters could help. Number 7. End plastic pollution. Plastic pollution is the ocean's new cancer. We need to ban unnecessary plastics and tax other single-use plastics, finally making them valuable materials we want to recover and helping to pay for the full cost of the environmental impacts. We need research and tech to prevent plastics from leaking into the sea, to overhaul our recycling systems, and to design economically viable alternatives to plastics. This progress may be accelerated by a proposed international Paris Agreement for plastic pollution. Number 8. Land. We can help the ocean by first setting a few things right on land. We must massively increase our ambition to save our forests, thus locking up a huge chunk of carbon dioxide. We need to stop wastefully spilling megatons of costly fertilizers into rivers that are creating hundreds of marine dead zones. Precision agriculture that optimizes fertilizer use, coupled with other farming reform practices, can help. Number 9. Wired ocean. We need more ocean data. This includes new tech to detect illegal fishing and connect sustainable fishers to consumers. We need tech to help endangered marine wildlife coexist with ocean industry and fleets of environmental sensors above and below the water to better study our rapidly changing ocean. Number 10. Ocean equity. To build a healthy ocean, we must ensure all people have a fair stake in its success and that they are no longer unevenly harmed by ocean health risks. The fate of the ocean will affect all people in all communities. Thus, we need people from all communities in ocean science, management, and policy. Fulfilling the apocalyptic predictions for a 2050 ocean will be all too easy. Altering that ocean future may be one of the hardest things we have ever collectively achieved. But the consequences of inaction will be even harder to shoulder, for us and our ocean.